you see a door. Above the door is written, Deep Dungeon Adventure! Are you ready for a tongue twister? Here we go. Today we're going to delve deep into Deep Dungeon Adventure on Doors and Dungeons. Whew. It's part two of our MSX talk with John Hsink, composer of this and many other MSX soundtracks. Initially, I picked this game because it seemed fitting for the first Doors and Dungeons game to have an equally alliterative dungeon title. In retrospect, though, I think it really is a unique way to start out, as it highlights just how vibrant and energetic the MSX development scene remains some 30 years on. The fact that new games for this system are getting a physical releases every year is just fantastic. This is kind of an interesting thing because the podcast is a retro gaming podcast, and I've decided to start it with a game that was made in, 2008, technically? It's not exactly retro yet, but it was designed for a retro system. Well, I guess it's almost 10 years old now, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking, time flies, yeah.
So, to give a little history of this game, I'm not sure when you could say it came, it was... what year you'd say, I guess you could say 2008. The back of the box actually says 2008/2009, but then if you look at some of the websites, they'll list it as 2010 because that's when it was released on the cartridge, or some might even say 2012 because that's when, or 2012, no, 2016 or 17 because it got re-released on Commodore 64.
What?
There's a port of the game for, I believe it's Commodore 64. And the reason it was done, there's a group that designs Commodore 64 stuff, and there was one of their members got cancer. I don't remember what kind of cancer.
Wasn't that the ColecoVision, actually?
Oh, ColecoVision, yes. Not Commodore 64. Yes, ColecoVision. Sorry, my mistake there. Yes, ColecoVision. And so the member got a cancer, and so they decided to quickly port a bunch of games and release them. And then use some of the money to support him in his battle with cancer.
I think it was his wife.
Well, his wife, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
His wife had the cancer.
Yeah, and I think they reached the goal. They did gather enough.
Oh, that's great.
Funds. Yeah, it is. It's really great.
So there's that. And then, so I'm not really sure what year, but I guess we'll say 2008 because originally it was designed for a contest in 2008. Right?
Yeah.
For people that don't know, that are kind of new to MSX, in Europe especially, and also Brazil, it's really popular. Well, I wouldn't say really popular, but it's popular among MSX fans to create homebrew games for the machine still today. And I think that's always been one of the successes of MSX, was that it was so easy for home users to create software for it. There's a lot of other systems where it's just not, especially back then. It was just not easy to do. And for this system, it was relatively easy to do. So there's a pretty big scene of people that still create games for it even now. And there's a contest. Are they still running this contest? They still do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. But the rules got a bit lighter. originally, the contest was conceived to inspire people to create games that would use just the basic specifications. So, the main rule was it should work on any MSX machine, no matter how small the memory is and other specifications. It should work on every MSX machine. That was the idea. But now the contest has two categories. One is the traditional one called Classic, which is in keeping with what it used to be. And the new category is Freestyle, in which you're allowed to use just any expansion or machine.
Yeah. So this is called the MSX Dev Contest. So your game, Deep Dungeon, won the 2008 MSX Dev Contest.
Yeah.
Now, so this is the kind of an interesting point here. Originally, you called it Deep Dungeon. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And when did it get changed to Deep Dungeon Adventure?
I think when we found out that there was actually already a game called like that.
Yeah. So in Japan, and this is something that I know about, but I don't think a lot of other people knew about it at the time, there is a series of RPGs called Deep Dungeon. And I'll quickly go into this. They're not made by one of them was made by Square, who's now Square Enix. But basically, before Square released Final Fantasy, they had created this partnership thing called Disc Original Group, or DOG, which is a pretty accurate way of describing a lot of the games that were released on it, because they were dogs. And their goal was to allow smaller companies to release games on the Famicom disc system. And so a smaller company could design the game, and then Squaresoft would help get it published. You know, then Square would get some of the money, and the smaller people would get their name recognition, and they would get some of the money too, I guess. And so one of them was a company called Hummingbird Soft, and they created a RPG called Deep Dungeon. It's a very standard, very, like, wizardry kind of clone, you know, first-person viewpoint, dungeon-crawling kind of game. It's not great. I've got it on the Famicom disc system. The packaging is wonderful. It comes in this big box. It's like the size of a VHS tape, and it's got this really beautiful full-color manual inside and a case for the disc, and the game itself is meh. And so this became a series. There was the first two were released on the Famicom disc system. And then Square actually released the third game themselves, designed and released the third game themselves on the actual Famicom cartridge. And that was Deep Dungeon. So Deep Dungeon 1 through 3. So then you guys find out later that there's already this game called Deep Dungeon, and then yours becomes Deep Dungeon Adventure. So how did you guys come up with Adventure? Like, was that just a good sounding word, or was there any sort of meaning behind it?
No. Can I use swear words?
I suppose so.
It was really just an ass pool.
it worked. It worked.
To distinguish it from so that people wouldn't think it was a port or something. You know?
Yeah. It works because it's something that Square did was to take Final Fantasy and take a game that was not released at all as Final Fantasy in the U.S. and call it Final Fantasy Adventure so that it would sell better. That's kind of the opposite of what you did. But one of the things that I found interesting about that was that it reminded me of the game Adventure. Have you ever played that on the Atari?
Atari 2600?
Yeah. There's a game called Adventure.
Yeah, was it like in Top View and like also a dungeon crawler kind of thing?
Yeah, it was actually in a lot of ways it's very similar to what Deep Dungeon Adventure is based on in the most extreme way. I mean, you're not really... you're sort of fighting enemies. You can pick up a sword, and kind of as long as you're holding the sword, you can attack stuff, I believe. But it's very similar in the visual style and sort of the way it approaches the world. It's overhead, and it's very, like, just very blocks for all of the different walls and things. And I believe it's also the first game with an Easter egg in it.
Right, I think I read the book a while ago, Ready Player One.
Yeah.
And I think that game is indeed referred.
Quite a lot.
Because it was the first game with an Easter egg in it. And of course, do you know the book?
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, because it all revolves around finding the Easter egg, you know.
And that was actually another question I was going to ask you is, are there any Easter eggs in Deep Dungeon Adventure?
Do you have the rum, actually?
I do.
Like, next time, that's actually hinted at the text of the ending. Next time, try to boot it with the escape button held down.
Okay. Hold down the escape button. Okay, I'll do that. I'll try to remember that. So, yes, I do have the box here, and I had a few questions I wanted to ask about it. Let me go ahead and explain what this game is. So, it's not Adventure, and it's not Deep Dungeon, but it is Deep Dungeon Adventure. And it is a top-down game, and I guess the easiest way to describe it is it's a roguelike in the purest, oldest sense of the word. It is designed to be just like Rogue or Hack or NetHack, if you've never seen those before, is basically imagine drawing a dungeon with little blocks of text and using a little at symbol as your character and just moving it around in this map that you've created.
And they're randomly generated.
Yes, and they're randomly generated, which is very important because the dungeons in Deep Dungeon Adventure are also randomly generated, and that's something that really defines a game, like the style of a game when it's randomly generated. It's always completely different from every other game when you have one that's like that.
That's part of the charm, we thought.
I think so, and I did like the fact, one of the things that I really liked was that you actually have a seed option where you can type in a number and it will generate the same maps. If you want to play it with friends or something like that and like, you know, go against each other or challenge, you can actually type in that number and play that map again, even though it's random.
That's also why we later in the version, we included the step counter.
Okay, so I was wondering what was the reason for that. So there's a step counter in the game. Every step you take is counted.
Yeah, and that was meant to be able to compete with your friends.
I did this dungeon.
I entered this seat and I did it in this many steps. Can you do better? That was the idea behind it.
I see. And so you can also collect gold in the game. And what was the reason for the gold? I don't remember.
The same. The gold doesn't have any real gameplay function. It's just a counter.
Okay.
It's just a parameter, you know?
So you could make a challenge, which is get the most gold in the fewest steps possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so the basic idea of this game is you're an adventurer, right? And way down at the bottom of this dungeon is an amulet. Let me look it up here. It's the amulet of...
The amulet doesn't have a name, right?
It doesn't have a name in this. That's right. It's in Hack that it has a name. Yeah, it's just Amulet. In Hack, it actually has a name. And it's like Yongel or something like that. But in this one, you just call it an Amulet. So you've got to get to the bottom of this dungeon, get the amulet. But unlike a lot of other games out there where the goal is get the thing, you have to get out.
Yeah.
Which means you have to go back up all the different floors that you started on. Which I think is, I'm guessing the original did that as well, the original Hack.
I don't think so, no.
No, I guess it didn't, because I was looking at it online, and now I think about it, you didn't really have the option to go back. But I think that's one of the things that I really find charming, is that you have to go back through this game. And
with an additional type of enemy that would be relentless, yeah.
So the game gets harder, but then also you're going back through areas that you've already played. So there's kind of like a fog of war, kind of a shadow where you have to uncover parts of the map as you're walking around. And every time you leave a map and come back, it's covered back up again. So you've got to uncover it again every time. So if you don't remember exactly how each room was laid out when you were going down, when you come back up, you end up having to explore them again and run into harder enemies. Which is, I think, is a very unique way to do the game. And one of the things that I really liked is, at first I didn't notice that was how it worked. Because when I first sat down and played, I just popped it in. I didn't read the instructions or anything. And I found the doorway, and I walked up to the doorway, and it said, you can't stop your quest now. And I was like, what? And I was confused. Yeah. I didn't realize that that's actually the exit. And I like that you can walk out the exit at the beginning of the game, and the game will berate you and say, you know, what kind of terrible adventurer are you you know, get back in there and fight that dungeon.
Yeah, it says you feel silly and you return.
So that was a great little touch that you guys put in there.
All right.
So the combat in this game is something that I really want to talk about because it's actually a combat system that I really enjoy. And I'm going to call this, this is my new phrase. You can feel free to pass it around the internet and make it a thing. I call it Bump of Attrition, which is kind of a play on a Japanese band called Bump of Chicken. And it makes slightly more sense than Bump of Chicken. Bump of Attrition is this idea that you bash into enemies, you bump enemies, like in the Ease games, if people are familiar with those. You actually have to ram enemies to attack them. There's no attack button. But, unlike the Ease games, you're not trying to dodge enemies or hit them at a certain angle or anything like that. It's literally just straight stats. It's, if your attack is higher, you hit them. If it's lower, you take damage. It's all about, like, simple math.
Yeah, you get hit less when your defense is higher.
Right. Yeah. And so I call this Bump of Attrition because it really is a war of attrition. It's how well you can manage your health and how much damage you're taking compared to how many enemies are on screen that you have to actually get through. And I like that style because it's got a little bit of complexity, but it's also something you can play very casually. You don't have to really worry about sitting down and spending time like mastering the combat system or learning all the techniques or skills or how to dodge this enemy or that enemy. It's just, you can just sit down and you could give this game to just about anybody and they could figure out how it works. And I like
Because the emphasis is on, well, navigating your way, you know?
Right.
And like deciding if it's wise to attack an entire group of enemies or maybe find another way, you know?
And so there's a lot of games that recently that do that. So in the past, there were games like Hack and Rogue that did that. But this Bump of Attrition system has actually gotten a little bit more popular. So in Japan, it was popular with a game called Dragon Slayer, which Falcom fans should know this game. It's one of the first big games that Falcom released. Not the first game they released, but the first really big game that took off. For the PC-88 system, and it's in a lot of ways, it's very similar to what you guys created, except you guys, as far as I know, had never played it.
Dragon Slayer.
Yeah.
No, I don't think any of us played it. Really played it. No, I didn't. I don't think the other two guys did either.
Have you ever seen it?
Yeah. Later on, but I didn't have the game growing up either. So.
It's really rare to come by now. So this game was released originally on the PC-88, and then it was ported to other systems, but the ports are not great. I have it on the Game Boy, which is an okay port in some ways and terrible in others. But what I've actually done is sat down and played it on an emulator of PC-88, which runs on PC-98. There's an emulator that was designed for the PC-98 to run PC-88 games, and it's a really good emulator, actually. And you can use hardware that's very similar, very, very similar to PC-88, which is an NEC computer that we'll talk about in another podcast. And you can play that game, and it looks like you're playing it on a PC-88, even though you're not. So, in that game, you're a hero, and you can pick up, as you go, you can pick up little bonuses to your attack and defense and so on that make you stronger, and you're just kind of walking around. But you have, like, a little base. You actually have to pick things up and take them back to the base to get that stat bonus. And there's one large world map that you're on. And it's really big for that kind of thing anyway.
Isn't it also randomly generated in Dragon Slayer?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it is or not. I know, I think some versions perhaps are and some versions are not. Right. I'd have to go back and check. But it may be. That may be the case. The game's been released on a few different platforms. It was released on MSX, but Square actually did the port, and their version is very different, or somewhat different, from the original. So that's kind of another fun MSX fact.
All of the first six Dragon Slayer games were all published on MSX.
Yeah, that's true, actually. All the first six? I'm not sure where...
Yeah, all of them. Yeah.
Really? I knew the first six Dragon Slayer. Yeah, not the Legend of Heroes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah,
no,
yeah,
only
yeah,
the
yeah.
first Legend of Heroes, which is Dragon Slayer 6.
Right. Okay, so we have Dragon Slayer that has this system. We've got its sequel, Xanadu. But more recently, we've got some other games. Like, one of my favorites is a game called Faerun, which is on 3DS, and 1 and 2 were on 3DS, and also now on the Nintendo Switch. It's a very similar system. It looks kind of like Ease, with a little cute little 8-bit girl who fights little enemies. But the combat system is the exact same thing. And it's very charming and cute, but I love how you run into enemies and you hit them. And then you've got to figure out, okay, can I attack this group of enemies? Am I going to get killed here? Or can I get back to the little healing space and save and heal, you know, before I run out? Or can I hit like three of them and then go and then come back? You know, that kind of thing. Or you try it and then you realize, oh no, I messed up. And then you've got to try and dodge stuff to get back to the healing spot. I think that's becoming more popular in Japan for smartphone games. I've seen a number of smartphone games using this system because it's so easy and fast to pick up, and you can make it into a game that you can just like, you can play it for 5 minutes and then stop and come back. And it's really easy to do that, especially with touchscreen controls, which are not great at maneuverability.
I can imagine that's a good format for mobile games, yeah.
So you're on the cutting edge of that, I guess you could say.
Well, actually, someone did offer to develop it for iPhone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he also wanted to use the rearrangement that I showed you of the music. So
since I've got you here, and you did compose the music for this game, I want to ask you a little bit about that. But first I wanted to ask you, there's three people that worked on this game, correct? According to the manual here, we've got Arturo Ragazzini, John Hasink, and Richard Cornelis.
Cornelis,
okay, and all from different countries, is that correct or no?
No, Richard and me are both Dutch. Arturo is Italian.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you are credited as sound. Arturo is credited as the code and Richard as the graphics. Did you work on anything other than the sound, or did you literally only work on the sound?
No, I did write the story, actually. Well, as much as there's the story, but I did write that, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, most of the text displayed in the game, and like the story and the manual and stuff, I wrote that.
So I can thank you for telling me to get back in there and fight those monsters.
Yeah, actually.
And I wanted to know, who drew the cover art for this game?
That was my brother-in-law at that time.
Really?
Yeah.
So there was a fourth person, secretly.
Well, initially, like Bitwise, who was publishing the game, you know, picked it up like, hey, we liked your game for MSX Dev, and we want to make a cartridge release of it. And they first proposed to have as a cover, like a generic picture of the dragon, which I recognized as being from like a Dungeons and Dragons rulebook.
Ah.
Actually the same picture that was used for the obscure Korean MSX game, The Three Dragon Story. Do you know that?
No, I don't know about that one.
Well, that game also used that picture, and we just thought it was lame, like we're not going to steal like existing art. We want something unique, you know, like we created this ourselves, so we want something new. So my brother-in-law is a graffiti artist, and he worked with airbrush and with paintings, and a very talented guy. And he mentioned that he enjoyed to draw dragons. He liked dragons and to draw them. So then I figured, like, hey, how would you feel about creating a like box art for a computer game, for a video game? And he said, yeah, well, cool. So what I did was I sent him the MSX1 color palette, which the game uses, obviously, and to base it on the colors. And I sent him like the pictures, like what the hero looks like in the game, you know, because, you know, you get a little cutscene when you get the amulet and stuff.
Right.
So I showed it to him and how the dragons looked. And he based his art on the in-game graphics and on the colors that were used. And, well, that's how it came to be.
I see.
So
yeah.
So we paid him a fee, and we scanned his picture in, and that's the story of the box art. Actually,
I'm really glad to know that because I really love this box art. It's this very classic mix of professional and amateur looking. It doesn't look hyper professional, you know, designed by some corporate guy kind of thing. No. It also doesn't look cheap.
No, I think he really went out of his way to, I think he did the most work on the dragon.
Yeah, you can definitely tell.
The most effort, but I think it does represent the game pretty well.
It not only does that, it represents the whole genre pretty well. It's so reminiscent of games of that era, especially like the fantasy games of that era, when you think about like the stuff that, say, Ultima or something like that, that they were trying to do with their graphics. It looks just like that kind of thing that you would see, and it really reminds me of the games that you had when you were a kid, you know?
Really?
I think so. I mean, it definitely reminded me of that style that we saw in books and games and things when I was a kid.
Oh, all right. Because I don't think he really based it on any existing game box art, you know?
Well, I don't think necessarily the actual art itself, but I think the style, like the way the shadowing is done and the way some of the different art choices are done, just remind me of different picture books and things that we had of like fantasy things when I was a kid. It feels accurate to the era, I guess is how I would say it.
Well, I like how he chose the perspective because, of course, he was given all freedom, you know. And he decided for like a kind of perspective where it really bleeds through that you're like a mere squishy, vulnerable human who is up against like a big, big, scary dragon. And there's like a corridor behind you and you're in a... You're in a maze, and I think it really conveys the meaning of the game. You know,
yeah.
He just nailed it.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I'm going to put the picture. I'm going to try to put the picture with the podcast so that listeners can look at it. But to just explain it, essentially, you know, you've got the dragon is like the main part of the picture. He's kind of in the foreground, and it's like the camera would be from behind the dragon. And the character is kind of in front of the dragon, and he's much smaller than the dragon. And he looks like he knows he's much smaller than the dragon. He looks scared. And then behind him is the wall and the door, you know, corridor.
Yeah,
the perspective really does show, you know, the fear.
Some people criticized the box art like they would have expected some kind of like a Schwarzenegger, Conan the Barbarian kind of figure, you know, like looking really muscular and powerful.
Yeah, but
you don't actually look like that in the game.
No, you don't. And I think that was one of the things that I found really funny about it. Because the original is, in NetHack, you know, that kind of thing, is you're just a at symbol, right? And so you guys with this game decided to really upgrade the graphics from those old style games. A lot within the, you know, the compatibilities of the MSX. And so it looks slightly more modern and also still very, very, very retro. But your character has like yellow pants and a blue shirt or something like that. I mean, he's just a very kind of a generic little guy. He doesn't look like some barbarian swords, you know. He doesn't look like Rastan Saga or anything like that.
No, exactly. That was the idea. You're just a guy, you know.
So that's one of the things that's cute about the cover art. Yeah, I'm looking at the picture on in the manual, and he's like a block of peach colored head, and then like a blue shirt and some red pants, and that's
and
it.
Red hair, yeah.
Well, in the pixel art, this does not even have a hair. He's just a peach head. Maybe that's his name, Peach Head. You could call him Peach Head.
Or you could just call him you. You know.
Yeah.
It's you.
I mean, the box art has kind of a gender, but the sort of, I guess, has gender. It's actually kind of not even. You can't exactly even tell from the box art if it's a male or female. You definitely can't tell from the in-game sprite.
Well, I like that. I didn't, to be honest, I didn't think about it that way. But it's of course a bonus if everyone can identify with you being that character that goes on a dangerous quest to retrieve that amulet and stuff, and that you feel like you're really embarking on a dangerous mission, you know.
Yeah, and I always like games that give you the option or at least leave it ambiguous enough as to what gender the character is.
I think it depends because, of course, if you're playing, let me name something, Bubble Bobble, you know, I don't think much people identify with being a dragon, you know.
No.
But it really, I think it depends on the game, and I think it's a nice new development in RPG games that you really get much freedom in creating your character, because I think that's actually at the base of RPGs. Like, you create a character and you want it to be like, the character doesn't have to be like you, but you could do it if you want. You could create yourself into the game. You like to be something else in the game, you know?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that Japan in particular had lost along the way, was because Japan has always had this focus with the JRPG moving more towards storytelling and less from the traditional sort of pen and paper style that a lot of Western games were based off of.
So you get like pre-molded characters.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes that's great when the characters are really well designed, but when you've got a character that's, you know, especially like the silent protagonist, they're not talking at all, and yet you have no control over how they look, it really limits what you as a player can feel for that character in a way. And recently, I think Japan's gotten a lot better. Like, for example, the Wonder Boy remake adds the option of Wonder Girl, so you can now play as a female character. And I was told that I've told that it even changes the title screen of the game from Wonder Boy to Wonder Girl. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, so the fact that they give you the option to choose something that you identify with more, because really, I mean, this character doesn't matter what the gender of this character is. There's no story for the character. There's no, other than the title being Wonder Boy.
And it doesn't matter anyway. Because I guess you know, like, the game Monster World 4.
Yes.
Which is technically a Wonder Boy game, but you're playing. But you're playing as a girl.
Right.
You know? It's a great game, of course.
Unfortunately, we didn't get it in America until very recently.
No, I don't think we got it in Europe either. But I don't want to blow my own horn, but have you played Tina's Adventure Island or seen it?
I have not yet. That's actually a game that I'm wanting to sit down with soon.
Well, I don't want to use this as kind of an advertisement.
No, please, feel free.
But I think it's one of the most, or maybe the most fun game I ever created a soundtrack for.
Really?
I really loved that project. I loved the game. I would have played the hell out of it back in the day. Actually, I did during development. It's like Wonder Boy, but this time because Wonder Boy is always in the first game. He is like rescuing Tina, right?
Right. Adventure Island is what it's.
Yeah. Like Takahashi, of course.
Right. Yeah, because and that gets into a whole craziness with Wonder Boy and Adventure Island. Won't go into that. But in
this game, you're Tina.
Ah, okay. So it's the same Tina.
Yeah, it's the same Tina, but this time you're rescuing Wonder Boy or Takahashi. I adore that game. It's my I liked the Wonder Boy game or Adventure Island games.
I did too. And I didn't get into it until just a few years ago. And once I did, I was so addicted to especially the Adventure Island. I actually sat down with it on the Wii because I could not do it without some sort of save states.
Well,
and
the MSX version is pretty playable as well, and I played it a lot as a kid. And what I saw, what David, or Imanok, how he calls himself, like his artist name, he really has a knack for great game design. He just knows what makes a game fun, you know, and it really shows. I really loved it. I loved creating the music for it. I recommend you try it out, really.
Yeah, I was actually just talking about ordering that soon, so I'm going to have to give that a go. So, pulling it back to Deep Dungeon Adventure here for a second, for the rest of the podcast. One other question that I had was, okay, so I think you told me that this was the first game you did with PSG, or at least the first game released that you were working on with PSG.
Yes.
How is working with PSG different from other forms of music composition that you've done?
Wow.
I know, it's probably a huge question, but...
Yeah, it is. Well, because, for instance, FMPEG, you can rely on pre-made instrument presets, you know. The FMPEG has some instruments or sounds, voices, that are ready to use, and you can play with them, you can tweak them, you can change them, but the voices are there. With the PSG, it does nothing by itself. You have to create, ideally, you have to create from scratch everything. Every sound, every drum noise, it isn't there, you know?
Is that with working with samples, or is it just, like, physically creating, like, tones with, like, hertz and stuff like that? I'm not sure how PSG actually works on that level.
Well, it is literally just a sound generator, and it can only generate square waves and noise, white noise. So if you want to make something sound like what the human ear would interpret, for instance, like a piano or a guitar, you make the way the volume goes in a curve, you know, you make the curve. Does ADSR say anything to you? It's the process that the dynamics, like the general volume, goes through.
Oh, okay.
So, for instance, a piano or a guitar will have a strong attack, like how the tone swells, like
right.
Fast, like dunk, you know. It will go like dunk, then it will
fade out, decrease
sound, and stay on that level, and maybe then it will decrease to, let's say, zero. If you want to create like effect like a slow string, you will make that attack, like when the tone reaches its peak, you will make that slower in time, that cycle. You will make it like, you know, you will make well on.
I see. You're essentially, it's kind of like, for example, someone with a guitar with an effects pedal, you're essentially having to program the effects into the actual tones. It would be like literally typing in the command of give this effect, you know, this much attack and this much delay and so on and so forth.
Well, you're creating the sounds beforehand that you are working with.
Beforehand? Wow.
Yeah. You're thinking like, I want to have a punchy bass line, for instance, you know? So you make it punchy and you're using that sound to play the bass line with.
That actually gets back to something that I wanted to talk about. The sound in this particular game is a little bit different, I think, than a lot of other games that I've played on MSX. It has a really punchy sound. It has lots of these little gaps in between. And I'll play a clip here for a second so that you can get an idea. This is the music for when you're descending, when you're first going like down the dungeon.
Thank you.
Okay, there's this sort of punchy sound to it, and there's these little, it's almost like when you're playing on a really old computer, there's like lag in between when the game's like processing all of the information it's getting, and there's like these little gaps in between where the sound should be. And it sounds like your music has these little quiet points in between certain notes that gives it this very classic sound that sounds to me more like, say, the Commodore 64 or something like that than it does the MSX. Was that something that you intended to do with it, or was it just something that happened as you were learning the system?
No, it's based on, I think you're referring to that the bass line, the channel, yeah. That's the bass line, shares also the channel with the snare drum. It's like the bass line is going like, you know?
Yeah.
And that's based on the way, especially more software developing companies did that, but especially Falcom versions of the East games on MSX, they were known to do that.
Yeah.
Like, which usually have like the galloping rhythm, you know?
Right.
We call it the bass. And when you put the snare drum on the, after, how do you say that in English? I don't know the English musical term, but when you normally put the snare, you won't miss the bass at that point.
Right.
So a lot of songs in the first three East games, which were the only ones published on MSX, of course.
Yes.
They were, the bass lines would usually go like,
right. So basically the bass line is designed so that in between the notes is a gap in the bass line for you to put the snare drum in.
Yeah, because you don't miss it as much, because
right.
your mind will fill in those gaps.
Which is odd, because it's not really like that in the PC-88 version, which the music was originally written for.
No, that's because the PC-88 versions have three FM channels and three PSD channels. So
right.
They could have. You can also hear it when you compare, like, the Nintendo 8-bit and MSX game libraries.
Yeah.
They share a lot of titles. And you can clearly notice that the Nintendo or Famicom has an independent noise channel.
Right.
So you don't have to sacrifice tones to be played, to play a drum sound, to play a noise.
But
so,
then sometimes people would use that for the sound effects too.
Well, yeah, you could, you know. You could use the noise channel for sound effects only.
And
you could,
some games would do that, and so you'd end up where you'd be walking through and you would attack or something like that, and then suddenly there's like a gap in the music while you're doing that attack, because it has to take one of those channels of audio from the music for your attack sound and then have the music start playing again on that channel, which is something that I think we noticed as kids, or at least I noticed as a kid, but didn't quite understand why.
Well, because it, of course, has to share channels.
Yeah.
You know?
So that was another a question that I wanted to ask was, who actually designed the... So you're listed as sound. Who actually designed the sound effects for the game? Did you design the effects as well as the music?
Yeah, I did the sound effects too. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to wrap this up here. Was there any other part of the game that you worked on specifically other than the sound? And you said the tech.
Well, I did a lot of testing, you know.
Okay.
When you're like an amateur like us, we didn't have like a team of game testers. It was just the three of us and some of our friends and family who like tested the game. Like, is it fun if we do it like that? And maybe we should tweak that stats more like that to make it less annoying. And so we all did a lot of game testing. But what I did the most was creating the story and the backgrounds, you know, and well, the sound.
So two last questions here, I guess. What would you say is the most commercially successful game that you've worked on?
Maybe Realms of Adventure. But let me have a look at my how you call it, showcase thing.
Your bio.
Yeah, it could be Zombie Incident.
Yeah, didn't that get released on, like, eShop or something later?
It has three versions. It has the first version was MSX version.
Yeah, I've actually got that game. I'm quite pleased with it.
Yeah, all right.
Well, I haven't beaten it or anything yet. It's a little bit challenging, but I like the idea.
Well, you were talking about sound effects interfering with the music, right?
The funny
thing is that the music, the in-game music of Zombie Incident, it uses only two channels.
Uh-huh.
That was a requirement because the replayer couldn't convincingly mix the sound effects with the music. So the requirement was like, could you make music that uses only two channels? I was like, oh god.
Can you just turn water into wine while you're at it? I mean, you know.
Yeah, like I was indeed like, you want me to do miracles, but then I figured like, the early Konami games on MSX also used only two channels, and the Hell Laboratory games, they also only use two channels. So I tried to think a bit like Bach, you know, like Johann Sebastian Bach. I was thinking like you can do a lot with two voices still. So
I think so, yeah. It just have to be talented.
That reassured me to create the music. But it got a Nintendo 3DS release then.
Uh-huh.
And also a Coleco version.
Okay.
So maybe that's the one that's most sold, but I don't know. I think those Sky Magazine games also a lot.
Yeah, those are popular.
I actually, to be honest, I don't know which game sold the most. I made the music for like 25 productions or something. I don't know. I don't know by heart.
Now, I haven't played the 3DS version of Zombie Incident. Did the music change for that?
Yeah, I made FM and PSG versions.
Oh, okay.
Actually on MSX, and I just recorded those, and they were used in the 3DS version.
Wow, so MSX getting pulled forward. Well, I know the developer for the composer who does the... Oh, I cannot remember the name of the games. Those dungeon crawler games for DS and 3DS. Etrian Odyssey is the name of it. The composer used to compose stuff for PC 88 and 98. What is his name? Really famous composer, and I've just completely lost his name.
Yuzo Koshiro?
Yes, Yuzo Koshiro, yes. He writes all of the music for those games on PC 98 using the FM of the PC 98 and then records it in his studio.
Oh.
To put into the DS and 3DS games. So you're not the only person who does that kind of thing.
Wow, I'm in good company, I guess. Wow.
Yeah. So you are in the same world as Yuzo Koshiro.
Well, some this is the first time I'm mentioned in the same sentence as he did, so I'm honored. Yeah, he, of course, his work has been a quite big influence on my work, of course, among others, but... I love this work, always.
So that leads me to the last question that I wanted to ask. What kind of game would you like to work on in the future, and or what kind of platform would you like to work on in the future? If you could work on anything, what would you want to work on?
Well, lately I have been mostly hired to make fantasy-style music. Mm. I would like... And a lot of shooters, you know, and my go-to thing for shooters is to make something pretty much up-tempo and catchy, you
right.
know, like you hum along while you're shooting things. And I would like to try again to make something more atmospherical and more, I don't mean soundscapes because my style is to make like catchy melodies.
Sure.
But something more sci-fi.
Yeah.
I would like again.
Something with longer notes and more of a controlled sound instead of just action.
More like a sound design thing. Yeah. More like synth-like music.
Right.
Maybe even more like a movie soundtrack kind of music because I had to do, sounds negative, but... a lot of more fantasy-style stuff, and now I would like something more, science fiction, I guess.
I've noticed there's been a trend among a lot of, like, more of the mainstream titles to go for this atmospheric thing, and they almost go too far with it, where it's just kind of like you're playing a game and your music is... And you're like, oh, okay. Like, I want music. Like, it doesn't have to be, you know, but I want something more than, oh, you know.
Yeah, it's modern music in games is too soundscapey for me.
Yeah.
It's more like wallpaper.
That was one of my biggest complaints with the Castlevania Lords of Shadow games, was that I could ignore all the other things they did that were not very Castlevania-y, but the music itself was the thing that I could not ignore, because Castlevania is so defined by its music.
Castlevania needs like the gothic, dramatic,
yeah,
Hammer Studio mix.
Exactly. So that was a big disappointment for me, and I guess maybe for you as well, if you ever had a chance to play those. If not, you didn't miss much.
Well, I did try that PlayStation 3. I think that's Lord of Shadows, Castlevania.
Yes. Yes.
I think I called it God of Warvania.
I did. I did too.
Maybe it sounds a bit purist or something, but that's not what I think what Castlevania is, you know?
I think that's pretty much the general consensus out there, is that it was a decent game that was not Castlevania.
Yeah, maybe the setting is, and maybe it fits into the lore, like story-wise, but...
They could have just called it Lords of Shadow and left off the word Castlevania, and it would be perfectly fine, but...
Yeah,
you know.
I agree.
All right, well, with that, I want to thank you very much for coming in here to talk about Deep Dungeon Adventure, the first adventure in the Doors and Dungeons podcast. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, too. It was really interesting and fun. I learned some new stuff.
No, thank you, really, for doing it. And I also want to give a big thank you to my friend and next-door neighbor, Michael Hudak, for creating the show's theme song. And to Tom Lipschultz, who stayed up until 3 a.m. helping me test my audio recording of this podcast, and also who helped me order Deep Dungeon Adventure, among many other MSX homebrew games that he's helped me get a hold of. Do you have any website or anything that you would like to plug for the audience before we go?
Well, of course, if you're interested in MSX, check out the MSX Resource Center. mrc.org. That's like, well, the main site for anything MSX. There are others too, like a Spanish one. For the Spanish people, there's msxblog.es. But check out msx.org, and to blow my own horn again, just look for my name on YouTube, and you can find a lot of soundtracks from mainly Japanese but also Dutch scene games, and my own stuff, and a lot of musical arrangements from games.
All right. I will post a link to your YouTube in the podcast description. If you want to know more about the Doors and Dungeons gaming podcast, you can visit www.doorsanddungeons.com. Also, you can follow us on Twitter, which is @DoorDun. That's Door, D-U-N. I also have a YouTube account, which you can find via the Twitter, and hopefully soon on the website. On there you can find streams and game reviews that I've recorded over my past 4 years in Japan. Very soon we're going to have a Patreon account, so that you can donate to help me create new videos, podcasts, and books. Until then, I hope you'll listen next time when I discuss the PC-98 computer system with the talented translators at 46 Okumen.